Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, episode 119 for Thursday, September 15th, 2011. Alpha Bet Soup.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store.
Hey, hey, hey. Greetings, all you webvillians out there. We've got another scintillating episode of Autoline After Hours. Johnny is in Frankfurt, face buried in strudel, I'm sure, by now. Joining me tonight, as always, is the lovely Sharon Turlip from the Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to see you. And Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production Magazine, of course, and AutoFieldGuide.com. So another exciting week in the biz. What's on your mind tonight, Sharon, in the biz besides the UAW thing? Are you covering that or not?
We have a reporter who's been thankfully staying up, every night until midnight covering that. Yeah. And I check in on the emails in the morning. And I can tell you he has been very hard at work. I think the union stuff is interesting. But compared to what the union stuff has been, there's nowhere near the fireworks. So, a lot going on. We'll have some, we talked about Chevy. It looks like there's going to be some news coming out of Chevy. GM, it's about board meeting time for GM, so we'll see what happens for them. And I think, just kind of business, it's like Everything's kicking back into gear.
Yeah. So let's beat the Frankfurt Auto Show to death some more this week since everyone has. Gary, what do you think of the Maserati Coupang, or the Sergio edition of the Grand Cherokee, as I refer to it?
Well, It seems to me that Maserati is taking a look at what Porsche is doing very successfully with the Cayenne, and the Cayenne is just doing really solid numbers for Porsche. And in fact, so I cheated a little bit by writing down some numbers. So I went to Autodata, and so for the month of August, they sold 882 Cayennes, okay, and 1,302 cars, okay. So 882, 1,300, all right? So for the year, they've sold 9,101 Cayennes and 11,393 cars. Okay, so that's, Autodata's numbers. Now, the interesting thing is the Cayenne sales are up 112.1%. Car sales are down 0.3%. So as you had on your site this week, there are those who want to have a Porsche in their driveway, and they're getting Cayennes, and they're not the true believers, but they're somebody who want the brand. Now, Maserati, for the month of August, sold in the United States a grand total of 211 cars, okay? And for the year, it's 1,507 cars. So, the Cayenne itself is handily outselling that. So what do you do? So do the guys at Maserati say, we're just going to ignore that, and we're just going to, quattroportes, and that's our world? Or do you say, let's do something in that SUV space so we can get some volume?
Yeah, well, the problem is they don't have the dealer network that Porsche does. I mean, you're talking about a bunch of sleepy Maserati dealers that, they work over, a rich couple for 4 months before they commit to buying.
Right.
And so they're not, the idea that they would all of a sudden be not mass selling SUVs, but that would transform the Maserati showroom to the point where I'm not sure they can.
Well, but let me look at Cadillac. I mean, Escalade is still, you know, a huge, huge success.
Yeah, but again, that's a huge dealer network.
But the point is that at least these guys may have the opportunity of making some traction that they don't have now, because it's taking them several months to be able to sell a car. And so suddenly there'd be these people who are like the people that may buy Cayennes who are saying, hey, I can get a Maserati now.
Yeah.
So you're not happy, I can tell.
No, what do you think about it, Sherry?
Well, I think, you know, anytime you talk about anything that company does, logic often doesn't apply.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, so I think that, you know, I think both those arguments make sense. But, I mean, I think if you just look at some of Sergio's, you know, plans.
Announcements.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, who would have thought, you know, just, and I don't know the sales numbers off the top of my head, but, I mean, he took a lineup, kind of refreshed it, spent a little bit of money on it, and their sales are, I think, where no one expected they would be. So he seems to be, the one thing that seems to be true is he seems to figure out how to sell cars, you know, and.
Yeah, the only thing he missed by a mile, and it really bugged me, is when he was kept making his pronouncements about Alfa Romeo.
Right, right, yeah.
You know, 2012. Well, now it comes out, they're saying, well, 2013 and a half. I don't think we'll see an Alfa in this country before the end of 2014, but.
Yeah.
So, I mean, would they put it in a Chrysler dealership, or would they put it in
a
Fiat?
The Alphas?
Yeah.
Oh, they'll put them in the Fiat dealerships.
So is that going to be sufficient to?
You know, I have no idea. I mean, they're going to bring that sports coupe over first, that Alfa. But as far as establishing a mainstream Alfa, and we've talked about this on the show before, I mean, think of the train wreck of brands in this country as it is, in this market. And they're all, you know, battling for their sliver of the pie. But launching a new brand, let's not forget that a lot of people don't even know what Alfa is.
Right.
I mean, even fewer people than had heard of Fiat mm-hmm. knows what Alfa is. And the older types who remember the Graduate. And then there's the Alfa, the Alfistes, the enthusiasts. But, you know, that's launching a brand in this country is a massive undertaking. So good luck with that. But, you know, back to this Porsche thing, my column was about the fact that Porsche is doing this dance between the consumerists who buy the, you know, the Cayenne and the Panamera and the true believers who have to have their 911 Cayman Boxster fix. And, you know, I have to admit, I wasn't a fan of the Cayenne. And I will say the new Cayenne is so dramatically different than the first one that it's not even the same vehicle. But Porsche's done a masterful job kind of doing this dance between these two factions. And, you know, you can't argue with the fact that the people, all the sales they're generating on Cayennes and Panameras are allowing them to do, you know, vehicle sports cars that you can lust after. So as long as they can keep the balls in the air, but at some point, you know, they're right on the edge. You know, you don't want to see them badge something that's clearly not Porsche worthy. Now, the next test, I guess, is the entry-level sports car shared by Volkswagen and Audi. What was the concept called in Detroit that Volkswagen, the Blue Sport? That was a diesel thing.
I can't remember.
But anyway, yeah, you know, Porsche doesn't have an, their entry car is the Boxster in the 50s.
Right.
So.
But you know, it seems to me that their engineering is sufficient to make it completely differentiated from the others, and so you wouldn't, I mean, yeah, people who watch this show would know, but, you know, the average person would have no idea that they're sharing these platforms.
Well, that's a whole nother thing, how well the Volkswagen Group has managed to differentiate all of these brands. I mean, and John and I were talking about the other day, they remind us of GM in their heyday, when they had all of these brands, but they allowed them to operate almost autonomously. And Volkswagen's kind of mm-hmm. much broader and globally, but they're kind of doing the same thing. And they've been doing a great job.
I mean, I see photographs of Seats, which, you know, are part of the Volkswagen Group. And you look at these cars, and they're gorgeous. And, you know, you don't realize that. Yeah. From looking at them, that the underpinnings are the same thing, you know, you're going to find in a Jetta. You know, yeah. I mean, it's amazing. Right. And so it's this clear design. Cues are owned by the brands, and then you know, the ride and handling, the chassis engineers do just such a great job on making these cars different.
I'm still not convinced that the Volkswagen plan for the U.S. is going to work as seamlessly as they hope. I mean, they decontented the Jetta. Now, granted, you can order up a Jetta to be like the Germanic Jetta you really want instead of the lost leader. And then they brought the Passat in. I mean, that's a big bet in Chattanooga, right, Sharon?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I think the thing, it's when you look at Volkswagen, it's, you know, first, where's their target? I mean, who are they going after? And I don't think that's quite clear. And then when you look at, you know, I mean, the brands they would draw from, you know, is it Chevy? Is it Toyota? I mean, how are they any better than what's already in those segments? And I'm not sure there's a great case yet for that yet. I mean, what they've survived on is kind of this, you know, quirky, you know, just being a different kind of car and going more mainstream, isn't?
Well, yeah, it was always, you know, the people who were enthusiastic about driving and appreciate German cars, it was the approachable German brand. Like, they could get a lot of that.
Right.
For an affordable price. And now they seem to be waffling or going in and out of where they're supposed to be. And I don't know how that's going to work for them.
I mean, that's why you...
Well, I was going to say, I mean, people used to like to drive Volkswagens because they had the hard, stiff suspension. Right. And, you know,
they felt Germanic.
And it felt Germanic.
They weren't as expensive as a BMW.
Ooh, I could be in the Autobahn with this car, right?
Right.
And therefore, you know, you feel that, yeah, you can't afford to buy a BMW. You buy a Volkswagen and say, I have a German car. This is great. Mm-hmm. But, you know, trying to appeal to the U.S. taste, you know, and you know, the case in point being Passat. So,
to increase volume.
But what becomes a differentiator? You know, as you say, if somebody's got a Malibu, are they going to say, gee, I need to buy a Volkswagen now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the number of people who get excited about not having a cup holder because it makes them feel European, like, I mean, I think there's a certain number of people, you know, and I don't know that it's, you know, like, you know, 10 times as large as Volkswagen.
I think they have cup holders in there, though.
Well, they do. They have cup holders. Okay, the last, yes.
But I'm just saying,
cup holders, but it's like you decide between, you have to choose between shifting and using the cup holder.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just sort of this thing that's gone away. I mean, but it seems to me that I mean, they do offer the diesel in the Pacific. It's just like, okay,
well, yeah,
who's doing that,
yeah,
right?
Nope.
And I mean, and those guys are able to at least say, you know, hey, this is a reason why. And I would think that they're going to do phenomenally well with that.
Well, I think Toyota's going to suffer. I mean, yeah, their Camry loyalists will get their Camrys. Mm-hmm. But it's so conservative, and this market is changing so rapidly mm-hmm. that 3 years' time, the Camry is going to look ancient. Especially with the Fusion coming out at the Detroit Auto Show, which is a dramatic car.
See, but I, in many regards, I think that for the foreseeable future, it doesn't matter for Toyota. It just doesn't matter. Everyone that they build, they're going to sell.
Right.
I mean, and the other thing to think about, I mean, although, you know, that they've been down the first half, now they're going to be back from, you know, the ramifications of the earthquake. And so they're going to be able to build everything again. They'll be able to, you know, have inventory that people will be able to go in and get what they're looking for. And, you know, it'll be really, really interesting to see whether or not that, you know, some momentum doesn't build.
Before we take our first commercial break, what about these very odd little EV concepts from Volkswagen and Audi and Opel at Frankfurt? I mean, I don't know what to say. I mean, the green movement is very, very much a factor in German politics right now. And, you know, the Frankfurt shows, talk about the hometown show, you know, for the whole country. And then they show these radical EVs. I just wonder if it's window dressing or they're really going to do it. I mean, they're spending a lot of money on it, that's for sure. But I think John was talking to Johann Denischen, and he said other than limited production cars, you're not going to see mainstream electric cars for a long time.
Well, you know,
I mean, these, you know, urban little buggy cars.
Well, I think something like that you would certainly see in Europe before you're going to see them here.
Yeah.
And I think that just has a whole lot to do with the congestion. And I mean, you know, you go to any big city, whether it's Paris or Frankfurt, and you see people are parked their cars on the sidewalk and just anywhere they can stick the thing, and which here in the U.S. we're like, you can't possibly
do that. Well, I mean, that's
and,
why the smart car had
right.
sort of a okay shelf life over there.
Yeah, or you know, or why the A-Class was sold and yeah. number there, and just you know, there's lots of mini cars, and you know, then there's the whole issue of taxation in terms of footprint and displacement of your vehicles, and you know, it becomes very expensive to own a car.
Yeah, but it's a dichotomy with the German manufacturer. You know, for the country, it's a source of pride. So this is a very.
It is. I didn't see the miles per gallon figures on the electric car. I mean, I would.
The Audi.
Oh, wow! That's a.
It's awesome, but I mean, you know.
I find it interesting how the whole movement now is that wheels are independent of the body.
I think that's kind of cool myself, but that's just me. It's wild, isn't it? Sure.
Yeah, no, I
didn't work out so
those
well.
Aren't like,
so
yeah.
well for the Prowler, though, did it?
Yeah. Well, Ben, let's take that first commercial break, and then we'll talk about some other stuff after that.
The Chevrolet Cruze is the car that is taking the world by storm, and a key reason is all the equipment that it offers. A driver information center, a USB port, ambient LED backlighting on the dashboard, remote start with a MyLink app, two accessory power outlets, one in front and one in the back for the rear passengers, OnStart, turn-by-turn directions, free for the first 6 months. Whew, there's just too much to list here. And you can check it all out at Chevrolet.com/cruise.
Yeah, and we like to, I'd like to thank Chevrolet because, you know, I know I piss them off on a regular basis down at GM. So we appreciate you guys helping us out to bring you this show. Sharon, what about the NADA lobbying against the new costly fuel regulations? That's not a shocker, but they're saying they're going all in.
Well, we've certainly underestimated dealers' influence to shape national policy before in the auto industry, so I wouldn't dismiss them at all. I mean, you know, a lot of the auto companies put on a happier face than what, you know, which is no surprise. So a lot of the auto companies were not happy, are still not happy. So I think NADA will get a lot of support, if, you know, even from, you know, I think there's a lot of people who are really displeased with CAFE who can't speak out publicly. And the dealers are the one group that can. So, you know, it seems like kind of a done deal, but, you know, we thought that a lot of dealers were going to close, and that was a done deal, too.
Were you surprised that the Detroit 2 and the Italian 1 were so, they acquiesced so quickly with these? Do you think they were just counting on things might change and to not make such a big deal out of it initially?
Yeah, I mean, they fought hard at the beginning, but it was, the turning point was really when it became clear they were going to get the, you know, they were going to get the review period in 5 years. And I also think the Obama administration just was pretty determined to get this through. And so the message became, you know, we're going to get this through. You can either be for it or be against it, but we're not going to, you know, we're not going to really move from there. And there's quite a few. I mean, some of the exceptions for trucks, I mean, a lot of that stuff will make it easier on Detroit than the initial proposal would have been.
Yeah.
So the NADA's position is that it just makes vehicles too costly by...
Too costly, and it will cost jobs. It will, you know, probably cost dealerships, more dealerships, and...
But predicated on what? That people will stop buying cars?
Well, I guess that's a logical conclusion. There's so much money that it will take people out of the market, and it will cost them their dealers, basically. But Sharon,
it would be like the opposite of incentives, that cars will be more expensive. And so, you know, when incentives go down, sales go down. So people will, you know, more, that it'll extend the life of the current vehicles on the road. Because if you have to pay $10,000 more for a vehicle, then you'll, you know, then you'll wait longer.
But, you know, Sharon,
I'm not saying it's my argument.
It just seems to me that OK, if everything costs more. Right, because everything has to get to that level, then
that means the base prices are going to be
right
higher.
But this basically means that if you want to buy a car, that's what it'll be. And if you need to buy a car, that's what it'll be. And at a certain point, the used cars will be gone.
Yeah, their argument is then people will stand down and not buy, and they'll just drive their pieces of you-know-what until they break.
So, but
which isn't good for dealers.
But doesn't this presume then that gas prices are not going to go up?
Oh, well, there's a lot of presumptions.
I mean, it's just like so. Basically, I mean, if you look at the vehicle manufacturers now that are really pushing the fact that they're providing cars that are 40 miles per gallon. I mean, when GM came out today and said the Sonic with the 1.4 turbo,
yeah, it gets
it's 40 miles per gallon, and you can get the Fiesta 40 miles per gallon, Elantra, Accent, Focus, on and on and on. So it seems to me that you're seeing vehicle manufacturers stepping up to this as it is and saying, hey, we understand that people out there are now looking very carefully at what it costs them in terms of gasoline prices. And, that really bites you every week if it goes up significantly.
Yeah. And, well, you made a good point, though. I mean, don't underestimate the power of these dealers in Washington, because a lot of these, congressmen, senator, they got there on the backs of these dealers, a lot of them.
Yeah, and I think it depends on how, it all comes down to how you look at battery technology. I mean, because to get to these mileage targets, it's going to require more electrification of vehicles. So, if you're in the camp that, that electric cars are going to cost $40,000 like the Volt does, and, the even gas prices of $5 or $6 per gallon wouldn't have it make economic sense. I think the government's point is in 15 years from now, hopefully we'll be farther along when it comes to electric vehicle technology.
Well, I think that's basically the underlying belief in the Obama administration and in the politicians in Washington, Northern California is, we'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. Something will happen. Someone will come up with a battery that's, weighs 3 ounces and is this thin and magically recharges and it'll all be good. But, plus who knows what's going to happen in the election. And what that's going to do to this? So,
well, that we were talking before about the new EVs that were shown. No, the Opel EV. And as I recall,
we have that Opel, that little weird little Opel.
And it says something along the lines that it can be recharged by a solar cell on the roof of your garage.
Oh well,
so. So there you go. Come on.
Okay, yeah, it's fixed. Done.
Done.
I see Coda is going to be the first mostly Chinese car to be sold in the U.S. for $45,000 full electric. I don't know. I think when people...
Are we still waiting for those BYD cars to be here?
Yeah, I think that's one of the... Warren missed that bet. It's one of those bad bets he occasionally does. But... the thing is I think people are understanding now that, wait a minute, if I can get something that gets 38, 39, 40 miles per gallon in the city, the highway, the compelling reason to just go blindly sign up for electric isn't there so much anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, gas goes up to $6, $7 a gallon, you just don't know. Anyone thinking that gas isn't ultimately going to keep going up, I think is silly. It's just silly. Of course it will. I mean, the new bottom, every time it spikes, the bottom goes up a little more, mm-hmm. So.
Well, and the thing is that, and as people correctly point out, it isn't that there isn't available petroleum, but it's just not so easy to get.
Yeah.
And so if you're an oil company and you're going to try to get that oil, it costs you more money to get it.
Right.
And so if it's costing you more money to get it, what are you going to do? You're going to charge Sharon more money.
Right.
And it's just as simple as that. And so, this thing of, there's just all this oil. It's just waiting for us to take it. Well, it isn't like at, what was that, when the original spindle had...
Spindle top?
Where they just did... it was just like the Beverly Hillbillies. It suddenly, you've got them...
The University of Texas. There's a big display of a... There's a working oil rig. Because one of the huge... underlying foundations of the University of Texas was,
Yeah, so...
Gushers.
So it will go up.
So Chevrolet says they're going to aim for a younger buyer for the next-gen Corvette. And, you know, for the viewers out there, listeners, the next-gen Corvette is a transitional car. It's going to look zoomier. It's going to be slightly lighter. The interior is going to be all fixed. No more hand-wringing, apparently, about that. But, you know, the median age or the average age and demographic of the car is mid-50s male. So I don't see them being able to lower that with the next car. I don't see how they're going to do that. What do you think, Sharon?
I mean, the Corvette, I think it will be hard. I mean, it's just not something that I think younger folks associate as, you know, the kind of car they want to buy.
Well, they might like it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it would seem to me they're not going to be able to afford it, so they just put it on the shelf with a bunch of other things, right?
Well, yeah, and I think I guess it depends. You know, when I think of kind of young professionals who could afford a Corvette, it's like they're not really in sports car, you know, mode. It's, you know, because they probably have one car, and that's the thing about a Corvette. If it's your only car, it's not that practical.
It's not, yeah, it'll never be it'll be an only car in the 60s, you know, when you were Route 66 and all that.
But. So it's appealing, but I don't know that, you know, would be appealing enough. But, you know, it sounds like they have pretty dramatic changes in store. I think Dan Akerson was speaking at Notre Dame, and he talked about the 911 in the same category as a Porsche. So we'll see.
And the Corvette.
Yeah. Same. Yeah. Or I'm sorry, the Corvette. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
Well, see, maybe they're going to bring that demographic from the mid-50s to the upper lower 50s.
Well, it's going to be an incremental move.
Right.
It's not going to be all of a sudden. Well, you know, usually people in their 40s who are just starting to look at those vehicles, you know, a lot of them have families and stuff. So a Corvette will always be like third car, you know. So I don't know how they're going to do that.
That's why they buy those Cayennes.
You know, all that said, though, I mean, the Corvette has kind of looked the same for so long. I think a really dramatic departure or a big change would get a whole lot of attention. And I think that, you know, that is one thing they have going for them.
Well, the bankruptcy cost them dearly on the Corvette,
yeah,
because they, you know, they could have brought out the new one much earlier.
Yeah.
And the current car, even though I still think it looks great, is stale.
Right.
So, yeah, they'll get a spike on the new one. I'm sure it's hot looking. I mean, I've seen enough hints at it that it'll be one of those vehicles of the moment, just like I'm insisting that the Range Rover Evoque is going to be one of the vehicles. Mm-hmm. I happen to see, and we were talking about this, you know, you can go to all the auto shows you want, you can look at all these cars under the lights, until you see them out in the road, you really don't know completely how they look, because some things I thought were going to look great on the road and they don't. I saw two Evoques going to the Birmingham dealer one morning, and they're not going to be available for another 5 weeks, six mm-hmm. weeks. And they are stunning on the road. I mean, there was a white three-door and a black five-door, nose to tail. And it's going to be one of the cars of the year. I mean, and I don't think the Range Rover, Land Rover dealers are equipped in the least for the onslaught of people coming in. So
you're anticipating big volumes?
I don't know about big volumes, but, you know, I hope they get their quality thing together, because I think all of a sudden it's going to be even more dramatic than the Cayenne percentage of Porsche sales. I think the Evoque is going to be like 90% of Land Rover sales, period. And they're just going to ignore the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to go to this because it's ultra contemporary looking and unlike anything else on the road. So that's going to be an interesting little market test.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, I think that company can use some success, since you know, you keep reading that you know, that the things are not going swimmingly well.
Well, I mean, I look at the Evoque as a no excuses car. I mean, everything should be executed, fixed, you know, no problems. You know, this is our best foot forward, and we'll see. I think it's going to be a huge hit if they can build them. I don't know. Mm-hmm. What else are you working on of late, Sharon, and at the whole journal there?
Well, I think the cafe stuff has been interesting. You know, one of the things we like to do with the paper is get into, like, kind of the nuts and just explain things, you know, that we take for granted. So We did a story recently on the Malibu as an example of how, you know, how cars are changing. You meet this cafe, and the response, I mean, I've rarely gotten as much response, and even when we were covering the GM bankruptcy, from consumers who it was as if they had slept through the whole cafe debate and then woke up, you know, because they realized, like, you know, my fender, I'm not going to have a spare tire. My fender's going to look like this. So I think,
Your grill moves.
My grill moves. It's going to cost more. So I think we're watching that really closely. And, you know, back to the point about the auto dealers, you know, when it was kind of a political fight, it was one thing and it was semi-interesting. But when these cars start showing up and the prices come out and all that stuff. So that's something we're watching pretty closely. You know, we're paying attention to, stuff. A lot of people have been coming out with stuff on plans for China. You know, we have Ford's growth plans there and GM looking at Cadillac. So China's always been interesting, but it seems like even more so.
Yeah, it's sort of, we were talking about before when that boilerplate.
Oh, yeah. This is great, Gary.
So
when a car company sends out a release, there's always like boilerplate at the end, and that boilerplate can be anything. They can just, I'm giving our viewers and listeners. They can put a minimal line, or like, we're the greatest car company in the world, or you know.
Generally, it's that.
Yeah.
We're the greatest car company in the world.
Yeah, and I noticed this too, but Gary brought this up.
It's the sort of thing that nobody reads. It's like the fine print, and so you get these news releases, and you know, you saw this one today.
Yeah.
I know that you saw this, and so it was just basically about, you know, GM and UAW agree to extend labor talks, and then there's just this very short paragraph about that. Okay, and then there's this very long paragraph that follows that, and so while I know you ignore them and I generally ignore them, and so I just happened to read this today for whatever reason. And I was just astonished at what General Motors says about itself. And it seems so different to me that they would go about it this way. And so it says, General Motors, one of the world's largest automakers, traces its roots back to 1908. With its global headquarters in Detroit, GM employs 208,000 people in every major region of the world and does business in more than 120 countries. GM and its strategic partners produce cars and trucks in 30 countries and sell and service these vehicles through the following brands: Baojiang, Buick, Cadillac, Chevrolet, GMC, Daewoo, Holden, Isuzu, Jiefeng, Opel, Vauxhall, and Wuling. So it struck me that it starts with a Chinese,
right,
and it ends with a Chinese. And then it goes on to say the global Chevrolet brand celebrates its 100th anniversary in 2011. And we saw the Chevy ad, so thank you, Chevy, right? GM's largest national market is China, followed by the United States, Brazil, the United Kingdom, Germany, Canada, and Italy. And I was like stunned that in this boilerplate they point out that their largest market is China.
Well, we'll talk about that. Ben, let's do another commercial break. We'll talk about this when we come back. First, a word from our friends at Bridgestone.
Bridgestone is featuring its third generation of run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Current run-flat tires can offer peace of mind for consumers, but the added mass and the stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. The new third-generation Bridgestone run-flat tires reduce heat and improve performance and ride comfort. Whether you're a program manager in the industry or just looking for a set for your personal car, check it out at BridgestoneTire.com.
Yeah, it's not really a startling admission by GM, but it's just, it points to this global shift. But to me, the Chinese market is still a crapshoot. I mean, at any time, I get the impression that the government can just, you know, alter the landscape anytime they want. I mean, they can go in and change the dynamic in that market, which is just foreign to us. I mean, we don't do that here. But I don't think the upward trajectory of the sales are going to be as nearly as great as they were because of the government's propensity to start messing with stuff. What do you think?
Well, I think there's two things. I think the thing with China is almost undoubtedly growth will slow down, but you're talking about a market that went from 1 billion to more than 16 billion in 10 years. So even, you know, a fraction of that growth
is still huge.
And it kind of makes the market something that nobody can ignore. So I think the difference is, you know, not kind of like beware China, but that, you know, China used to be a place where you could really just like stumble in, send anyone, and then, you know, sell a ton of cars and make money. And now it's a place that's requiring, you know, companies to make, you know, big, important strategic decisions there. You know, and I think with the boilerplate, it's funny because I normally wouldn't pay attention to boilerplates either, but it was a big issue in the GMPR ranks when Toyota outsold them. Because if you'll remember, the boilerplate used to always say GM, the world's largest automaker, and they said it for about 6 months. And then they changed to one of the world. So, you know, but I think some of what that reflects, too, is also a company that's run by, you know, more Wall Street financial types than Detroit types. Because I think, you know, they're fairly unflinching about the fact that, you know, we're a global, we're a global company. We care a lot about China because it's about the dollars.
So do you think that, you know, you're saying that companies have to make strategic decisions because of the importance of that market. So do you think that if, say, the Chinese people started liking green cars, that we would see here a lot of green cars? I mean, to make it very simple. I mean,
you mean would the Chinese market start to influence our tastes here?
Well, there's a lot of hand-wringing about going on about that.
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily, you know, influence our taste as much as to say, okay, if I'm a vehicle manufacturer and I know that this ginormous market likes cars that have
huge back seats
and window shades.
Right.
That so you spend all of this engineering money to create vehicles that have giant back seats in window shades, right? And so to amortize those costs, you've got to sell it elsewhere.
Right.
And, you know, second biggest market, United States, right? And so just as what our tastes were in this country that affected the rest of the world, is it now going to switch? I mean, do you think it's going to switch?
I think definitely. I mean, I think it depends on what kind of cost and technology you're talking about. I mean, definitely, I think China with their electric vehicles and a lot of that, I don't see how they can't influence the rest of the global market. I think influencing the larger influence could take more time. I mean, because it's still, I mean, China's huge in numbers, right? But they're still the revenue. They're still not making the kind of money there. So it's hard to imagine that, you know, they would start that automakers would start selling cars in the U.S. that they sell in China because they're not making a ton of money off the cars they sell in China to move them over here. But definitely, I think with the technology. But I mean, the battery stuff that's going on over there is really interesting.
Well, yeah, but I mean, again, there's an environmental issue with their coal-fired plants and where all their energy is generated from, and I don't know where that's going. But I thought it was interesting. Back to Frankfurt briefly, as Mercedes again showed up with hydrogen. And, you know, I've been a big believer in hydrogen, although no one seems to want to figure it out. But, you know, it's one of those things that's always 20 years away.
Right.
We're gaining on it. Well, when's it going to happen? Another 20 years.
Didn't Zetcha say that car is going to be 20 years? I mean, literally 20 years.
You should put, it's interesting. I noticed in passing, you know, because hydrogen, GM used to mention hydrogen all the time.
Huge.
And then they didn't. And I noticed recently it's been coming up more. So I wonder if that's.
I haven't heard that they've.
Well, been. No, just things like, you know, not an announcement, but I think I read somewhere, you know, GM's pursuing technologies, and then they mentioned hydrogen cars where that had seemed to have been absent for
a while. But isn't the Toyota supposed to have a hydrogen car next year? I think that.
Well, you
2012
know,
they have now.
Honda's got the demo fleet in California right now, but I
thought that Toyota is going to.
Well, it's pretty hard for a manufacturer to sell cars in this geographic area because that's where the hydrogen filling station is. Not exactly a profit model of any kind, but
right.
I think we'll see a lot more natural gas. I mean, it seems like natural gas is what everybody really wants to.
The conversion of natural gas to fuel. For the car seems like a
right.
So I mean, like the I mean, there's the Civic natural gas that you can buy, which
I'm kind of surprised. I mean, in a strategic way, that the U.S. hasn't leveraged its natural gas more for mass use, you know, in cars. But that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of performance, I mean, it's pretty ethanol-like. I mean, in terms of you don't get as many miles per gallon with the fuel, and then you really attenuate trunk space more than you attenuate trunk space with a battery pack for a hybrid vehicle.
I think I read this right, but you know, the big thing about hydrogen, the fuel cell, the storage tank, onboard storage tank, I mean, obscenely expensive. But I thought I read this correctly about that show car that Mercedes unveiled at Frankfurt. They said that the tank was spread throughout the outer skin of the vehicle. And I was saying, how can that be?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I must have read it wrong, because I'm just off the top of my head, for impact and stuff, doesn't seem like it's the right way to go. But I'll have to read some more about that.
Well, they're making them basically those tanks with carbon fiber. So if you had a carbon fiber shell on your car, then...
Yeah, but I mean, I've studied those tanks extensively, and they are unbelievably thick and unbelievably difficult and expensive to make. So maybe it's one of those Mr. Wizard. Yeah, we'll figure this out in 20 years. So, Sharon, have you driven anything lately that you...
Well, I drove... I don't drive the fanciest of cars because the journal actually has to reimburse for the car, so I have to have a reason to drive them. But I did get to drive. What was very interesting is I drove the Volt and the Chevy Cruze back to back, and I actually like them both very much. And I can see, you know, I mean, it's all that stuff that we kind of know and that we've heard and been told about, you know how the appeal is based on kind of driving behavior. But it was really interesting because I drove the Volt, and I had it for a week, and I did take a couple trips that were more than 100 miles. So I think when it was done, my miles per gallon was, you know, it was like 62 miles per gallon. And I really loved the car. I was like, we should buy this car, and it's great, and it's coming, you know, and all this stuff. Not, you know, I wasn't necessarily ready to spend that much money, but I was a fan. And then I drove the Cruze Eco, and we had to drive three people in the back seat, which we couldn't have done in the Volt, and it was really fun to drive. And by the time I was done, it was 42 miles per gallon average. So, you know, it really struck me just on how, I mean, I guess if I was just a city driver, possibly the Volt would make a lot of sense, but I'd be hard pressed to spend that kind of money, I think.
Yeah.
But isn't that car sort of, I mean, it struck me that when it comes to alternative powertrain vehicles, everybody suddenly becomes an accountant. Okay, everybody does the math, right? But if you're going to buy a Camaro or a Corvette or a Charger or you know a Mustang, you don't do the math.
Yeah,
you just say this is a great car. I want to buy this car. I don't care how much gas costs. I love driving these things.
Well, exactly. So if you are a sports car enthusiast, like I would not pay $40,000 to drive or $50,000 because I'm not and so if you are an electric car enthusiast, then by all means. Yeah. But if you're not, you know, it's hard. And that's not really a dig on the Volt. I mean, in some ways, I think, you know, these kind of electric cars can be hurt by just the improvements in traditional cars.
Because, yeah, like we were talking about, 40 miles per gallon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so I really like the Volt. But then I really like the Cruze. And it was, you know, and it was... harder to justify
it's good
that
for
extra.
Chevy, they have both.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's
just like, so the geeky people really want the technology to be able to say, hey, I've got this stuff.
Right.
You know, it's just like somebody saying, I've got a Hemi.
Right.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I understand the fierce, you know, activism of the Volt true believers. Right. It's cool. I had one for a week. I loved it. I thought it was great. I still think it's a technological tour de force by GM engineering in a short period of time, which people outside the business have no idea what they pulled off with it. And it works seamlessly pretty much. And it's a real car. Mm-hmm. Like the advertising says, it's a car, you know, that happens to be alternative.
And just think if it looked like the Ampera, the European old version.
Yeah.
It's just like... Oh.
They could afford to go radical with the next Volt. They need to reskin
that. That is just...
They need to reskin the Volt quickly so it stays top of mind, out front. They need to go really visionary, I think, in the design. They need to push it. I mean, GM certainly has a talent to do that.
Right.
They need to do that.
Well, I think with the Volt, it's kind of walking the line between two worlds. Like, on one hand, it's, you know, this is kind of a car that everyone can have.
It's
a... Oh, yeah. you know, it's a car that doesn't look like a Scion. It's kind of mainstream, but I almost think it has to not be that in order to be worth $40,000. You know, it has to be kind of a radical, flashy, showy, you know, different kind of car, because you can't just sell it as a
right.
You know, compact car.
This is a regular car, but it gets really great gas mileage. But I mean, because you're not, you know, you're buying it.
I think they've established that. I think their next move really should be like, oh wow.
Yeah.
See, I mean,
like to do with the exterior, because the interior just blows. I mean, it just blows you away, the interior. Mm-hmm. So if you could do more of that.
See, and I mean, in terms of, and I mean, and that's one of the things that basically Toyota had done right with the Prius, that you know, you maintain this certain look for the thing rather than, you know, going all over the place. So you cement in people's mind
that it's different.
That it's different, and even
looks different, drives different, does different things,
and it's, you know, and it may not be what people expect or want, but it's still different.
Yes.
And that becomes its staying power. So as you see, as they morph the thing, they're still keeping that profile.
Well, you know what GM would say to this argument, and they say, well, that's good, but the Chevy version has to do this. Now the Cadillac version is going to be the radical design statement, but I think they need to push the Chevy too. So how about you? Have you driven anything that you've...
I drove the Veloster that I can't talk about, but next week I can talk about it, but this week I can't talk about it. But it's interesting. I mean, if you look at what Hyundai is doing in this market, I mean, it's just
it's just unbelievable.
And you know, they're talking about their inventory on the ground. I mean, they have so few cars because they're just selling. And
I was just, we were talking before you got here. I was driving next to a brand new Elantra today. And they had just picked it up, and it was a gunmetal color, and I was looking at it, and I was just like, damn, the thing has great presence on the
road
for the price point.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the Elantra is a better execution of their fluidic sculpture design language than the Sonata is.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I think the Sonata looks lazy. I mean, and
the Elantra is taut. Taut.
Yeah,
nicely
it's got
done.
A very nice presence, and but again, I mean, and that, you know, Hyundai is just like pushing like mad to have 40-mile-per-gallon vehicles right across
driven.
The board. Now, I mean, they're going to be hard pressed to get a Sonata that's going to be doing that. But they are on an
upward trajectory. And matter of fact, our next sponsor are those happy, shiny people out at Hyundai, and we'd like to thank them for helping us. And Ben, why don't you run that Sonata spot?
With gas prices where they are these days, if you're after fuel efficiency, you need to check out the Hyundai Sonata. There's three different models to choose from. The 2.4-liter GDI, which delivers a segment-leading 35 miles per gallon. Then there's the 2-liter turbo, which offers 274 horsepower, yet delivers 33 miles per gallon, and the brand new hybrid that provides a combined 37 miles per gallon. And you can learn a lot more about each one at HyundaiSonata.com.
So I think we've arrived at that wonderful point in the show where we get all our feedback from our viewers and listeners. Ben, let's run the rapid fire. Okay, we're going to go quickly. This mine_Volkswagen says, make the next boat look like Cars and Blade Runner. I'd hit that. Okay. Mitch says, why is Sergio so miffed at Bob King? Didn't Bob King not show?
Yeah, I think Bob had things other than the negotiations that he wanted to do. And
really?
Sergio was
you're the head of the UAW?
Got other things to do?
Yeah, what do you got? Clean out the garage. Oh. And mine, Volkswagen says, I'm not impressed enough with the new Passat to replace my 2003 Passat with one. Okay. Comment from Jeff W. Anyone have any kind words to say about the passing of the Crown Victoria? Ford needs a rear-wheel drive architecture stat. They need to. I know they're working on the 24 and the new Mustang. There better be more off that rear-wheel drive chassis.
Well, I think what they also need to do is keep in mind that the Crown Victoria was a very content-rich vehicle for not a whole lot of money.
Right.
And
well, that's a classic American car thing.
Right. But, I mean, so, and if you look at Taurus, it's a big American car that costs big American dollars.
Yeah.
So,
good point. Hey, Ben, do we have a phone call?
Hey, Peter. It's Jonathan out in Old Japan. I have to tell you, you and your guests are putting on a fabulous, fabulous show. Of course, anytime you talk about Corvettes piques my interest. Just a comment. General Motors is moving to lower the median age of the Corvette by offering a new drug that instead of getting older each year, we get younger. I've been a Corvette owner for over a dozen years, and once you buy one, it's tough to pick another sports car. It's such an amazing car. I'm looking forward to the C7. My question is, you think it's going to have 475 horsepower above or below that number in the base model first year? Take a guess. Make us laugh. I thank you very much. Have a nice evening.
Thanks, Jonathan. I'm guessing the standard Corvette will have 450 in there.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the base,
right.
Base,
yeah. Let's do another phone call, Ben.
Nothing else yet.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Hey, thanks for paying attention out there. Really love it. Okay, from Austin in South Carolina, is it just me or was the Opel E-Rack concept the most useless concept of the show? I think it did nothing for the brand, and with Opel barely making money, it seems like a waste of resources due to its lack of being produced. I mean, Ben's got some footage of it, but I mean, you got to understand that these concepts at the car shows, some of them are just pure.
Although they did a very interesting thing, and it's, you know, geeky engineering sort of thing. But basically what they did was they said, okay, rather than make some really exotic structure, we're going to use a steel space frame and we're going to cover it with normal plastic.
Yeah, okay. That was smart.
And they were, you know, so they made an incredibly light vehicle using standard materials.
Using old school materials.
Right. And so if you take that thinking, then maybe they're actually the cleverest of them all.
Mm-hmm. All right. Oh, George from Brooklyn wants to know what is Volkswagen's relationship with Zuki right now. What relationship? That's going to blow. Done. There's the Opel. I mean, you know, personally, I love all these radical little things. My most favorite radical city car of all time was Gordon Murray's Rocket. Still today, if I could get my hands on one, it was basically a formula car for the street. It was one plus one seating. You sat behind the driver, and you have to wear helmets in it because you're exposed, but it was a great little car. How many of those 15,000 Saabs sold this year were the GM-built Saab CUVs, asked Jim Haynes.
Well, the 94X, they haven't been on the market that long, so it certainly isn't. I'm sure that that's maybe in the hundreds.
Right.
Okay, Mike D. White, question for me, having seen both Cadillac and Lincoln future products, who has the brighter future? You guys want to comment on that?
They asked you.
I know. All I can say is I'm impressed with both for different reasons. I think Lincoln might be reaching more, which might be hit the sweet spot, but we'll see. I think the full-size Uber Cadillac sedan that's coming, that was teased with the
CL.
The CL is fabulous. It looks fabulous. So we'll see. I hope they all are successful. Jay Cujo wants to know, a while ago, Caddy was said to have a Lambda vehicle of its very own. No news has come out since. Is that still a possibility, or has it been scrapped? Please say it has. Don't need another Lambda.
I'm not aware of it.
Yeah.
I haven't heard anything.
I've seen a design execution based on the Lambda for an Escalade that looked great. But I haven't heard
them. So take it off a truck platform and then put it on that.
Yeah.
Which they may need to.
Because I think they're going to have
the aforementioned cafe.
I mean, I saw it. I thought it looked great. Ed Joris, Libertyville. First, when it's appropriate, you might want to discuss with Peter, what does Honda have to do to become relevant again? What do you think they should do?
I think they ought to go back to being Honda.
Exactly. I mean, well, here's a perfect example. Toyota's coming out with the FRS. Rear-wheel drive, compact, pure little sports car, that car should be a Honda. Now, if Toyota's smart...
Although that, but if you go back to Toyota history, that car can be a Toyota.
But see, Toyota
Supra,
could...
I mean, what...
Yeah, Toyota could make real inroads with it if they go after where Honda used to play.
Right.
Now, Honda's, I guess the chief engineer or something said, oh, we're going to be back. We're doing a new NSX, blah, blah, blah. But boy, they've just missed it. They've missed a... It's a huge hole. They got to get back to being Honda. Absolutely. Ralph Engelbrecht wants to know if any of the hybrids needed their battery replaced, and if so, how much did it cost? I don't know.
Well, they're under warranty for now, so if they have...
Right, and Toyota's had some phenomenal life on Prius that, I mean, is amazing everyone.
Right.
But,
Glenn E. wants to know, does anyone know the price of the Smart Electric? The Albany, New York dealer has one for sale on his website, but no price. No, you don't want to know either. Keep walking. comment from
a few cars you can actually use your arm as the backup warning detector.
Now that's too involved. Political thing. Glennie wants to know, is the future diesel hybrid in order to reach the new standards?
I think some are thinking about it. I think people are thinking about it.
No, I mean, it's technically, a brilliant solution. It's economically a nightmare. I mean, because basically, as we know, that hybrid systems have a premium and diesel systems have a premium.
And the diesel system doesn't get much help from the government.
So you take two premiums, met them together, and you have a giant premium. So, yeah, great fuel efficiency, though. I mean, because of the way that both of those systems work.
George in Brooklyn wants to know who's going to win the police car sales war. I don't know.
Whatever happened to Carbon Motors? Do you know anything?
Interesting.
Purpose-built police cars?
Yeah. No, I think pretty much Chevy and Ford and Chrysler are going to bury whatever. I think the Charger looks like a badass police car. It's funny, you know? Chrysler, way back to the... Highway Patrol days, which
Roderick Crawford.
And now he drove Fords, but then there was a transition. But it's amazing to me that Chrysler has this heritage of police cars, and they always manage to come up with a car that fills the role perfectly and looks badass doing it in the Charger. And then Chevy's got the thinly disguised G8 in Impala trim, and Ford's betting on the Taurus and the Explorer, and I think Ford's going to be wishing they had a rear-wheel drive car right about now. David Burlingame in California says the 50 mile per gallon CAFE standards have been all over the news. I do agree with the inclusion of pickup and other SUVs in that pool. But what about all the other places where motors are used? Long-haul trucking, airplanes, boats, generators, lawnmowers. Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, you can have these standards, but if you can't have affordable service vehicles and trucks and, that's a real issue.
Well, I mean, the trucking industry is just undergoing a new regulation in terms of emission controls.
Right.
And, I mean, it's like 2014 or something that they have. A really strong bogey to meet, and which is separate.
Yeah.
From,
well, I think it's interesting, because commercial vehicles in many ways lend themselves well to being plug-ins and hybrids because they have a regular route.
Yeah.
And the military is actually doing a ton because they have is doing a ton to clean up their vehicles and reduce.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that, from the military point of view, that if you're sending people far away, you don't have to send gasoline fuel is heavy.
Right.
So if you can have more efficient vehicles, and I think that they're probably doing a lot of work there, that maybe that's where going to be the magical, very thin 3-ounce battery that recharges itself.
But it costs, huge dollars.
They'll get it from Area 51.
Yeah. Hey, Ben, do we have another phone call?
Yes, we do.
All right.
My name is Clem Zarofsky from Belmont, Pennsylvania. Just to one up the Corvette owner that called in. I'm 77 years old and still driving a new Corvette, and the wife and I left in 1959 in a brand new Corvette on our honeymoon.
Wow.
So Corvettes have been made part of our life, all our married life, and I hope they continue to be build these things. Thank you.
Well, you're awesome, sir. I applaud you and your wife. That's cool. Anything else, Ben?
What's it called for Jonathan Brown?
Okay.
Hey, Peter, it's Jonathan again out in Old Japan, New Jersey. Listen, a real quick question. Is the Alfa Romeo brand ever coming here? Sergio, the CEO of Fiat, Alfa Romeo, Chrysler, is ruining all credibility by just delaying this introduction of Alfa Romeo year after year after year. How are the Fiat dealers with the little 500 going to survive without a higher-priced product like Alfa Romeo? How are they going to survive selling the Fiat 500 in the quantities that it seems to be doing? Yes, it's nice that Jennifer Lopez is in the ad. My question to you is, what do you think of that advertising? Is the Jennifer Lopez ad going to attract the Fiat buyer? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Again, a great show.
Thanks, Jonathan. Well, there's a whole bunch of things in there. First of all, I'm concerned about the Fiat dealers. I mean, once the first on the block people get their fill of the 500, then what? Is it a sustainable thing like many?
Yeah.
That's a good question. Now, they say they're going to do a small CUV. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to have a tough road waiting on Alpha. And we talked about Alpha earlier. Realistically, they're saying the middle of 2013 now, but I would bet it's 2014 before we see Alphas here.
Well, I mean, Fiat's got its hands full in Italy now because of European sales. I mean, it's the car market in Europe is doing horribly, and therefore, where are they going to be getting the investment to do things? And so they're pushing back a lot of programs just in general in terms of, you know, their bread and butter for that market, to say nothing of saying, okay, you know, let's bring a whole new car. And as you said earlier, I mean, launching a new brand in this country is not a cheap thing to do. No. So you're going to have tremendous investment in doing that. And
it's
where are you going to get the money?
The first check you write to launch a brand in this country is $250 million. That just sort of gets you in on the radar screen just barely. And then you have to keep spending.
Mm-hmm. So
that kind of marketing money on a low volume thing like the Alpha, I don't know how they're going to do it. And, you know, I think the Fiat 500 is cool. I enjoyed driving it. I just wonder what kind of legs it really has. I mean, I think it's going to be tough. It's going to be very tough for these Fiat dealers.
But they do have that JLO ad.
Well, as far as the JLO ad, I mean, we talked about this earlier. I mean, it's kind of a star-crossed thing with Chrysler. I mean, they had Celine Dion with the Pacifica and the 300, and, you know, this is kind of a nonsensical thing.
Have you seen the ad?
No, but I just can't imagine Jennifer Lopez actually going out and buying a 300, which I think is like, you know, where the M&M ad was a little more.
Well, she's in a 500.
Or, I mean, it's 500, sorry.
It's a Cabrio, though, yeah. So.
Oh, yeah, okay, that makes it all better.
Yeah.
It's quite a, then at the end, she gets out and dances.
Oh.
Sweet. Whatever.
I'd like to watch the commercial.
It's not my favorite. Excuse me. Well, you know what? I think we've reached the end here.
Actually, we've got one more call if you'd like to take it.
Sure. There's the ad there. Sure.
Oh.
There's a lot of skateboards, motorcycles, and
I kind of see Jennifer Lopez.
People running. Less of the car.
Okay. You got the phone call, Ben?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Tim from Indianapolis, and I hate political things, but the other night when Mr. Kane was up, he mentioned that he wanted a panel to go together if he was president to pick on the EPA from the people who've been abused by it. I just thought that was a brilliant idea, and I wanted to see what your panel thought. Thanks.
Who said that?
Herman Cain.
Oh. He's anti-APA. Yeah, I don't really have nothing. I don't have anything to say about it.
You mean the EPA as in their, yeah, I mean, I think.
I think that there have been factions, again, Northern California politicians and Washington politicians and New England politicians who are quick to make pronouncements and without really understanding the ramifications of what they're talking about.
Right.
That seems to be a general pattern. And I don't know how, I don't see that ever changing.
No, I think you know, people have legitimate concerns about how much information is out public. You know, there's big decisions being made, and a lot of times, you know, the information as to why and how those decisions aren't, you know, aren't out quickly. So I can see.
Okay. Well, thanks again, Sharon Turlev from Wall Street Journal.
Thank you.
Gary Vasilash from Auto Field Guide, an automotive design and production magazine. Gary's got one of the coolest magazines. We really appreciate the ins and outs of this business. It immerses you in stuff you'd never know, and it's cool. And Sharon's always in the Wall Street Journal, so you should check her out.
Check us out tomorrow.
Huh?
Check us out tomorrow.
What do you got tomorrow?
I can't say. I'm sworn to secrecy.
Oh, okay, fine.
But it did come up today.
Okay. You can read Gary's stuff at Automotive Design and Production, the magazine, autofieldguide.com, and twitter.com/autofieldguide. And Sharon is at twitter.com/SharonTurlip, or, of course, you go to Wall Street Journal Print or WSJ.com.
Thank you.
And you can visit my website, autoextremist.com, and I'm twitter.com/autoextremist. And there is a Facebook site for Auto Extremists, and I thank my colleague A.J. Morning in Maryland for maintaining it for me, because I'm sort of an absentee landlord of it. And, you know, you can check out Autoline on Twitter, twitter.com/Autoline. And you can also friend Autoline, the gang here on Facebook, to get all kinds of content throughout the week. You can find Autoline's page at facebook.com/AutolineDetroit. And I'd like to thank everyone out there in Webville and listening, and Simon, wherever you are, hi. And Roaster Jack, thanks again for your coffee to keep us going. And John and I will be back next week, so we'll see you for another Autoline After Hours 1 week from tonight. Thanks.
Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.